Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, my name's Jess Phillips, and this is Yours Sincerely. I've always been a prolific letter writer, both the good and bad kind, and know the power of putting words to paper. So in this podcast, I want to give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Natasha Devon, MBE, is a writer and mental health campaigner. She founded the Mental Health Media Charter and wrote the young adult novel, Toxic. Today I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. So, Natasha, hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Apart from being a bit perimenopausal and a bit warm, all good. Natasha, this is all about letter writing. It's lovely to have you on.
Thank you.
Are you much of a letter writer?
Massively, yeah. I'm big into thank you notes, and people rarely send them these days, but I think it's the way I was raised that I just think it's polite to always send a thank you note. And recently my great auntie, I think she is. Yeah, she's my nan's auntie. So that would make her my great great auntie. But she died a couple of years ago. And when they cleaned out her house, they found just about three shoeboxes full of thank you letters that I'd written. She'd always send me £3 on my birthday. And then I would reply, but like with an essay, because I've got two brothers and they were raised to write thank you notes as well. But they'd just write, you know, dear Auntie Peggy, thank you for the £3, you know, love. Whereas I'd be like, today I did this and this is my favourite subject at school and I'm watching this on TV. And yeah,
I got a thank you note this week and I didn't get to open it because my children's great auntie was around at my house. I was away for the weekend and my children's great auntie was around at the house. Auntie Linda, who lives by the sea, that's what they call her. And she was in my house and she saw this letter, and because it is postmarked from Buckingham Palace, she was like, can I open your letter? You've got a letter from Buckingham Palace. So it's not actually from Buckingham Palace, it's from Clarence House, but it's from Camilla. And she just sent me, look, there you go. Thank you very much for your wonderful support you have offered to my reading room. I mean, it wasn't much effort, Camilla, but it's nice to get a thank you note, isn't it?
But doesn't that make you feel special and appreciated to get that?
Oh, God, it really did, especially because Auntie Linda, who lives by the sea, made such a massive deal out of it. Like, I was like, yeah, sure, open it. I get that sort of post all the time. And she was just like, oh, la-da-da. I get that sort of post all the time. Yeah, it's really nice. But she's not just written thanks for the thing. She's written a little bit. So she... You know, our future queen is grateful for your letter writing, is what I think. Setting a good standard from the top there.
I also write letters from my cat to my mum. because this started because My mum's at an age now where all of her friends have grandchildren. And my mum could not be less bothered about not having grandchildren. But they're sort of sorry for her. So they're always like, oh, I'm sure it will happen for you at some point, and you don't know what you're missing. And my mum's like, precisely, I don't know what I'm missing. Like, it's fine. But I did point out to her that she's got a grand kitten. And therefore, yeah, now they're in correspondence.
And how does the cat feel about this? I like to talk to my cat about, like, you know, European politics and things. So the cat's very, very learned, actually, my cat.
I have one of those cats. Actually, one of my colleagues at LBC said the other day that I've got a metropolitan liberal elite cat, because she's a house cat. She's very spoiled and she's scared of everything. So she just looks slightly startled all the time.
Did you pay £1 million for that cat?
No, nowhere near.
You paid £1 for that cat.
Somewhere between.
Because I personally don't believe in paying for animals. I think animals are basically pets that I have had in my life. I've only ever come from somebody's had a litter of kittens unexpectedly, and or like a relative has died, and so you have inherited their dog. That is how animals. But people these days are spending £1 million on cats and dogs. I find it.
It was weird, actually, when we insured her, we had this conversation with the insurance company where they asked how much we paid for her. And then they said, oh, and if she dies, would you want a clause that says you get that money back? And we were like, no, it just seems such a clinical way. It's like, yeah.
I'll do that with kids.
You can't do it with kids.
I mean, definitely, it might make it a bit tempting to harm them. They had insurance on them. That is so weird. Like, what financial settlement it would be tolerable if your cat died? Also, how do you prove it? Could have just gone missing?
Exactly. I'm learning French at the moment, and they don't say pet. They say animal de compagnie, a companion animal. And that's so much better way of describing it, I think. Because you don't own them, do you? They just live with you.
I mean, my cats barely live with me. My cats are not really cats. My cats came from, during lockdown, a cardboard box outside someone's house in my constituency. Like, obviously, I'd arranged to meet them there, but she couldn't come out for the house because it was lockdown. And so, yeah, she's like, my cats had a load of kittens, put it on, like, the local Yardley Facebook. I was like, I'll have some of your kittens. Yeah, they don't stay in the house at all. They're like travellers. They're getting fed all over this neighbourhood. My cats are the opposite of spoilt cats. So the letters that your mother sends to the cat, they are loving letters of hope for the future?
Yeah, I think she tries to channel messages to me via the cat. So she'll say, you know, I hope mum's well. Please remind her to do this thing that I reminded her about a couple of weeks ago. She appreciates that she has such a well-mannered grand kitten. And she now has a response. You know, when people say, have you got grandchildren? She says, no, but I have got a grand kitten that writes to me. What can your baby human grandchild do?
And also, I mean, even when they can write, it's like getting blood out of a stone, getting them to write a letter to anybody. So, you know, you're definitely on a considerably better deal with a kitten, I'd say, than a child. I mean, they don't talk back as much. They'll write the letter when asked. I think your mum is onto something. So, I mean, you made yourself sound slightly like a crazy cat lady, which I like.
Oh, I'm totally embracing that label. That's fine.
I really wanted to become one when I got cats, but my cats have such disdain for me that I can't even obsess about them. I'm barely part of their life. So I did want to become a crazy cat lady. I really like the idea of, like, I met a woman yesterday at the baton relay and she brought her cat out in a pushchair.
I've seen this. I think it's brilliant.
I was like, that. Oh my God, there's a cat. It was like a really big one. It looked a bit like a Maine Coon, but a bit smaller than a Maine Coon, but it looked like a Maine Coon-y cat. And it was there. It wanted to see the baton relay. It wanted to take part in the history of its city. Who could blame it? So it was brought out in a cat pushchair. Shoot, I was like, do people look at you like your crackers. And she was like, no, people are just pleased to see the cat.
I was talking to my friend Sharu about when we first got our cat. We got it from a woman who lives down the road, and I was describing her house, and I said, it was literally everywhere you looked, there were just cats on top of cats. Just, I've never seen so many cats in my life, of all different sizes. There were baby ones, you know, right up to adult. And I was describing it to my friend, and she said, the thing about this, Tash, is you're describing this woman's house like it's goals. And I was like, no, it is. It totally is. This is the life I want. Just cats everywhere.
Just cats everywhere. Yeah, well, I mean, that and learning French, you can probably become like a character from literature.
Yeah, and I'm wearing I went to Malaysia and I got a kaftan, and it is the most comfortable sort of brushed cotton kaftan. So I reckon if I get a turban and some big earrings, I'm there, am I?
You are away. I mean, you've got the uniform, you're learning French. You can say like French sentences to people as if they would understand, and then give like a knowing look as if everybody understood you, and nobody has. And you would be like a genuine eccentric. My French sister-in-law, funnily enough, just sent me a text message. Over the years, my French sister-in-law has basically deposited any number of her neighbours / cousins at my house because they wanted to learn English. I've had about 7 of them over the time that she's been married to my brother, which is nearly 20 years. I've had like 7 random French young people come and live in my house. And my friend wants to send her daughter's doing French A-level, and she said, oh, is there any chance she could go and stay with them for a bit in France? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll ask them. So I said, basically, it's your turn now. I'm afraid Birmingham teenagers aren't as genial or as polite as your French teenagers, but I'm going to send one over to you. And she sent back to me. She said, oh, of course, we'd be really happy to have her staying with us. We will introduce her to some French culture, the garlic festival, skiing on a slag heap and metal music. So
now, do you think those young people that you had come to stay with you, do you think they go back to France and speak English with a Brummie accent? Because if they I love that for them.
Yeah, I like Bjork. Bjork speaks English with a Cockney accent. Like, that is like absolutely brilliant. I really hope that they do. My nephews, who are bilingual, and their dad is from Birmingham, they speak French. When they speak English, they have both a sort of slightly thick French accent, but also a Brummie accent. So they say like Yowda instead of Yoda. And that is just, it's so charming to listen to their, we call it Frummy, because they're like French Brummies. They sound so cute. And they're a bit older now. They're less cute and they become teenagers, but they still have Birmingham accents, so that's cool. And they use Birmingham words, which I like, which when they try and say them to their teachers don't recognise them, which is a bit like being a Brummie politician with hands up. So I've asked you to think about, have you got any letters of note that you've kept forever? Like a letter telling you got a job, or a letter from a monarch?
I did. When I got an MBE back in 2015 for services to young people. And when you get that letter, it's so weird because there's no post stamp on it and it's not addressed. It just comes through your door. And then inside it says, don't tell anybody that you've been offered this thing. Just tell us whether you want it or not. And you think, did this come by owl? did an owl drop this through my letterbox? I don't understand. But yeah, I've kept that one. And I also, I don't know. And I should make it clear that I don't think this anymore. And I don't know why I wrote this, but I remember I wrote a letter to my granddad during my first year at university. There was a girl in my halls that was from Manchester, and she was very loud. And she was the first person that I'd met from Manchester, the only person I'd met from Manchester at that time. So I just thought all people from Manchester were really loud. So I must have written in this letter, why are people from Manchester so loud? And he sent me back this card, and it had a cartoon bumblebee on the front, and it sort of got two wings, and he'd written in the wings answer to the Manchester question, and then he put, because they have 2 football teams to support and have to compete with the shipping canal.
I think that's accurate.
Do you?
Manchester. I think that people from Manchester are quite loud. I think that that's probably the explanation. I've not heard a better one.
Okay, I'm glad. I'm glad I'm not in sort of portraying some inherent bias.
Yeah, no, I like that. Your granddad's bias is about Manchester and the Queen. We're on a par there. I mean that's the sort of healthy. That's the Britain I want to live in. That is the Britain I want. One heavy load of cynicism and one sort of sentimentality. I like both of those things. Right then, so I've asked you to think of three different people you would want to send a letter to. So the first one is somebody who means the world to you. So who would that be?
So I realise that this is probably quite a cliched answer, but it has to be my mum. It just has to.
Cliches are cliches because they are true. And like, so, you know, your mom being epic is what you should think. So that's good.
She is so epic. Do you know, I had my book launch for my novel Toxic a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of the LBC producers came, who you will probably know, you've definitely spoken to them on the phone, but they're mostly in their 20s, early to mid 20s. They're all, you know, very cool, and you know, they're young people who work in media. So a lot of them were there. My mum turns up, just charms them all. And afterwards, they were coming up to me going, "Your mum is iconic." And I was like, "Guys, I wrote a book. Does anyone want to acknowledge that I wrote a book? Or are we just going to talk about my mum?"
I mean, that is what you want, though. I mean, secretly, you do want like a mum who, like, you know, turns everybody's heads in a room. That is. I went to the Mercury Music Prize one time. It was when Skepta won. And I sat next to his mum. What a woman! That's like that. I really like your mum, Skepta. She was an absolute cracker of a woman. Yeah, you know, great mums. Great mums make great artistic, creative people. So, and does she live in London, your mum?
No, she's back in Essex. That's where I'm originally from, in the kind of rural bit of Essex. So it's not that far from London, but it could not feel further away when I go home to visit. But yeah, she's when people meet my mum, they're always like, "Oh, okay, you make sense now," because she's incredibly opinionated, and you know, she likes to rant about things, and she's very lefty. Like, she was a women's libber, so back in the 70s, so she was one of those people that was like on the women's march with a sign saying, "I can't believe I'm having to do this shit again," you know. One of those. She is pretty iconic. But she's, my mum got model scouted when she was in her late teens. She went to the London College of Fashion, and for a long time people used to talk about how beautiful she was, and she still is. Like, she's a very good looking woman, but because she's older now, she's in her mid 60s, it's not the first thing that people notice. And I'm actually really glad about that, because she's got all of these other qualities. And I used to get really annoyed when people were like, "Oh, your mum's so stunning," and I was like, "Yeah, but that's the least interesting thing about her. Like, have a conversation with her," kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like much of a curse, but I can imagine. I think that we probably all quite like, but I can imagine it must be really irritating to, like, you know, for people to be so bowled over by the way you look. And it doesn't matter what you wear or how you present yourself, like, for people to be like stopped by your beauty when you just want them to listen to, you know, the fact that you know you're complaining about the food or something. It's like, God, this is a tedious thing that gets in the way of everything.
She's spoken a lot, my mum, about not being kind of viable fertility wise anymore. And she said, you know, a lot of women talk about how you become invisible after a certain age, and she loves it, because she's like, you know, people are actually having conversations with me, and I'm old enough now that I don't care about pleasing them, and I just say what I think.
I can't wait to be really old. Honestly, I can't wait to be, like, I'm already perimenopausal, so I feel like I'm gonna go full on swing into it. But like, I can't, I like that sort of moment of like just letting yourself be your biggest self, like just being like whatever about everything. I got it a little bit after I gave birth for the first time, which, bear in mind, I did that when I was like 23. I got sort of like, there's no embarrassment that is ever going to compete with literally being split open in front of like a room full of people, and like you sort of don't care about things so much. But yeah, I really can't wait for like that poem where it's like, she said, you know, when I'm old, I'm going to wear purple. I can't wait for that. I'm really looking forward. I'm like, you know, cat lady sort of territory.
Did you read that Caitlin Moran column where she talks about how when you're premenstrual is actually the only time when you see the world as it is? And because you feel really angry and grumpy because there's a lot in the world to be angry and grumpy about, but the rest of the month you're just off your tits on estrogen.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. Oh God, I'm so annoyed just before my period. And then I'm like, when it comes, I'm like, oh, it's all right. I don't hate all my family, my job. And she's right. It's because I do hate them. They're just made tolerable by the hormones. Oh God, women, we have a crappy time. So do you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I've got two brothers who are, they're much younger than me. They're 8 and 9 years younger than me. So I'm more like a kind of second mum type figure to them, and incredibly protective of them. Like whenever they have a new partner, I'm like, what's their name and address? If they hurt you, I will go around there.
Yeah, that must be nice for your mum as well to have somebody who's like tag teaming it.
Yeah, we were very much, because my youngest brother was very premature. He was 4 months premature. He was born at 25 weeks. And so in addition to all the health complications he had, he's only 10 months younger than my other brother because he was so early. So my mum really had a time of it. So I was
in the same school year.
Yeah, because my brother was a summer baby as well. So in addition to being so early, he's also a summer baby. So he was...
no way. That's so like having like twins, but not like, you would assume that people were twins if they were in the same school year.
A lot of people did think that they were twins. Yeah. So I was very much mum's helper during that time.
God, that must have been absolutely terrifying for her to have a 10-month-old baby and then have a premature baby. Your mum must be absolutely nails. That is like, you know, the kind of trauma that scars. That is, must have been tough, man.
It was a really tough time. And one of the things that is often the case with premature babies is my brother's lungs weren't fully developed. So he had really severe asthma. So you couldn't let him cry. You had to get to him and calm him down. Otherwise, he'd have an asthma attack and he could have died. And for the first 5 years of his life, he woke up every 2 hours. So my mum was up every 2 hours for 5 years. And so sometimes I say to her, like, mum, do you remember, you know, something that happened when I was 13? And my mum's like, nope, no memory of that at all. Was severely sleep deprived the entire time.
Oh God, your mum is a legend for that alone. I mean, that must have been so hard on her. Yeah, no wonder she was into women's liberation. That is the kind of experience that will make you be like, what? Oh my God, the burden of all the world is on your shoulders. That is nails. So how would you sign off a letter to your mum?
Well, I was thinking about this. My mum plays rhythm guitar in a blues band. Whenever I go back home, I sometimes do guest vocals with them. And I was thinking about the role of the rhythm guitarist is so underappreciated. It's always the lead guitarist and the vocalist that gets all the glory, but they are keeping the song together. Without them, the song means nothing, right? So I think what I would say is thank you for being the rhythm guitarist in my life.
So the second letter I asked you to write was for somebody who's no longer with us. So who would that be to?
It's going to be Dr. Cochrane, who was a teacher at my school. And he, how do you even go about describing this guy? Like, so he kind of he was really tall and he had this massive presence, and he had these really bushy eyebrows that he kind of fashioned up into these owl-like peaks.
That's dead, that now. That look is dead. We need to bring it back.
Yeah, and he used to talk about how his father was a sergeant major in the army, and he knew how to do this shouty thing that was the loudest sound. And it wasn't even shouting, it was this booming thing that was the loudest sound you'd ever heard in your life. And he didn't do it often, but if ever any of us were really naughty, we'd get the sergeant major treatment, and it was absolutely terrifying. But he was actually really into Byron. That was his thing. But I knew him because he used to direct the Shakespeare productions. We had an annual Shakespeare production at our school. And I was terrified of him, but respected him so much. And he, looking back, was actually really cool and edgy. He would swear during a time when, you know, teachers didn't really do that.
I was a kid, like, that would have been apt. I remember once a teacher said bastard, and it was literally, we talked about it for about 4 years.
And he also was responsible, because I went to school during Section 28, and I remember we were doing The Merchant of Venice, and the character I was playing, Antonio, who is the merchant that the play is named after, is in love with his best friend Bassanio, and we were talking about whether that's reciprocated because Bassanio is also in love with Portia. And he said, well, of course Bassanio is bisexual, as many intelligent people are. And it was the first time anyone had ever used the word bisexual, and I knew at that point that I fancied boys and girls, but I didn't know that there was a name for that. And I was thinking, am I gay? Oh no, I don't think I am gay. Maybe I'm just a bit weird, I don't know. And then there was that moment of, oh, there's a name for it. And Dr. Cochrane said it, so it must be true.
I mean, it man's a doctor.
Yeah, he's a doctor. Yeah. And he also used to do this thing called, he used to get up in assembly and he used to do this thing called Mistake of the Month, which was all the teachers, if you made the mistake of the month, you got like a special sticker that said you'd made the mistake of the month in your exercise book. And it was things like writing as well as opposed to as well. You know, they're two separate words. And you come up and present to us what the grammatical mistake of the month was. Yeah, he had such a profound impact on me. And yet I think that I was always so intimidated by him that I never properly conveyed that to him. So that's why I'd like to write him a letter.
Oh, he was obviously a very learned man. He was a doctor. And we had doctors at my school, and we used to just be like, oh, you know, Miss Susie's got period pains. Can you help her? It's like, yeah, I'm a doctor of mathematics. It's like, you're no good to us. I mean, Dr. Cochrane sounds like he has all the hallmarks of a teacher who could have been quite conservative with a small c, but in fact was liberating and eccentric and good. Also, we definitely need to bring that eyebrow thing back. I used to see it all the time when I was a kid. I've not seen it for a long time. Although I feel like the hipsters are bringing back ridiculous moustaches a little bit more. Except my husband, when Boris stood down, my husband was like, he didn't know who half the people were, the candidates. He's like, I like that Ben Wallace one. And I was like, what is it about Ben Wallace that you like? And it, you know, Ben Wallace, to be fair to him, has got quite a lot of good qualities that one could understand why my husband might plump for him to be the Prime Minister. But his reason was is he's gone bald in an old-fashioned way. He's got the sides. He's got the sides, so it was like that, you know, like Jean-Luc Picard. He was like that. Why doesn't everybody go bald like that? Well, when I was a kid, everybody who was bald had the sides. Like now, everybody goes like really, really, like they shave their heads. And he was like that. I like that Ben Wallace. He's gone bald in an honest way.
But you know, I feel like the point that your husband was making is that going bald in that authentic old-fashioned way says something about the nature of the person, which is better than that standard answer you'd get from people when you said, why do you like Boris Johnson? And they'd say, I like his funny hair, but which tells us nothing about his character.
Yeah. Well, other than that it's fake. Yeah, his hair is a total element of fakery that he, I mean, you watch him as he walks into Prime Minister's Questions, he messes up his hair. It's like on purpose. Horrible. So Dr. Cochrane, what would you, how would you sign off the letter to this amazing, so he was an English teacher.
That right.
Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that your school did a Shakespeare play every year. That's pretty good, isn't it? We did like Greece.
Yeah, well, I went to a school that was, it was a comprehensive, but it was all girls, which is really unusual. And I think it you know, it had ideas above its station a little bit, you know.
We didn't do Shakespeare plays so much because obviously growing up in Birmingham, you are right next to Stratford. So basically every year you were traipsed over to watch Shakespeare plays. We used to do that quite regularly. We'd go over. And I like the fact that Shakespeare probably would have sounded like me, and that never is very well represented when he's depicted. Yeah, we didn't do Shakespeare plays so much. Yeah, like Greece, Little Shop of Horrors, that sort of thing.
We weren't allowed to do Greece, famously, and we thought at the time that that was because our school were too uptight. But now I look back on that and I go, that is a story about a woman who literally changes everything about herself in order to get a guy, and that's literally the whole story. There's no other plot points. That's it.
To be fair, you're right, there is no other plot points. There's a little bit of abortion drama, which I have to say I feel was left out of the play that we did at school. Yeah, you're right. Although there's plenty of Shakespeare plays of people trying to pretend to be somebody that they're not on. I think basically Greece is probably based on a Shakespeare
play. That's probably true.
How would you sign off your letter to Dr. Cochrane? Great name as well. I mean, he's just, Cochrane is a great name.
I think I would say, thank you for being weird. Yeah, weird in the best possible way.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So the last letter I've asked you to think about is for somebody who's had an effect on your life but wouldn't necessarily know it. So who would that letter be to?
There were so many contenders for this. I had a list and I had to narrow it down. But I decided ultimately it's got to be Eddie Izzard.
I love it when it's people who you don't necessarily know that well as well. I love it like when people say like Taylor Swift is the person who's had the greatest effect on my life. I'm like that, man, your mom must be pleased. So why is it Eddie Izzard?
So I remembered when I was in sixth form, I did religious studies for A-level, and there was a girl in my class called Ellie. We were doing Noah's Ark and Ellie started talking about, what about all the evil ducks and the evil fish that would have survived the flood? And I was like, that is such a good point. And it's also the most hilarious thing I've ever heard in my life. And she said, oh, it's not me, it's Eddie Izzard. And I was like, Eddie Who, and she lent me, she had like a VHS tape of Dressed to Kill. And I remember I had to, having two brothers and one TV set, you know, this is why I grew up loving radio, because I never got it. So I remember I had to like sneak down in the middle of the night to put this VHS tape on and watching it and going, I have never seen or heard anything like this, because, you know, it's history, it's philosophy, but it's also a bit surreal. And I just, I remember it just grabbed me in a way that nothing's ever had ever grabbed me before. And since then, I would say stand-up comedy has become my thing, you know, like some people are into music and, you know, whatever. But for me, stand-up is, I would say, the art medium that I, you know, I most make the effort to see new acts. And, yeah, you know, if you wanted advice on who to see stand-up comedy wise, I would be the person, I would say. But it all started with Eddie Izzard. And the thing is, I mean, I just find her so massively inspiring for so many reasons. I have met her once in the flesh, twice via once over the phone and once over the internet. But there's such an imbalance there in terms of, you know, when you just are such a massive fan of someone and you think, I can never meet you as an equal because I just love you so much that I'm just going to come across as a massive fangirl. And therefore, you know, you're going to walk away and think, oh, that's just another person out of my millions of fans that adores me. Normal day for Eddie Izzard. Me, I'm like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. So that's this immediate imbalance. And that's why I thought I would write a letter, because...
Yeah, that is a better way to communicate with somebody that you don't know if you're going to act like a total...
Right. Which I did on all of the occasions.
I'm sure you were better than you thought you were.
No. So the first occasion, I waited for her at the stage door. She came out. I said, I can't believe I'm standing in front of you, and then ran away. Right. The second time...
I mean, I think that maybe that could have been...
Yeah, ran away. I was just too overwhelmed, ran away. The second time, she was at my uncle's college doing a kind of inspirational speech, and it was my birthday. So my uncle phoned me and then handed the phone to Eddie and said, it's my niece's birthday and she loves you, can you say happy birthday? And I was like, I just love you, I just love everything you do. And she was like, well, you have very good taste. And that was the end of the conversation. And then the third time I interviewed her for LBC, and you can still see the video footage of it, where she's talking and I'm just like literally head on one side, just looking totally gormless. There might as well be hearts around my face. I cannot act like a normal person around her. And this is a problem, which is why I need to write a letter.
Yes, I think that writing a letter is the solution. I suppose that's the entire purpose throughout history of the love letter, because it's much easier to say that stuff, I think, if you're writing it down, or at least to prepare yourself for the calamity of a situation. Specifically with like it's much easier to be horrible to people, actually, in reality. It's much harder to like bare your soul and tell somebody that you love them and that you adore them and everything about them, because it's kind of cringe, isn't it, for everybody involved. Whereas actually, like, spitting barbs at someone, it happens as easy as pie. Eddie Izzard came out campaigning in my constituency, knocking on doors in massive heels. I was just like, this is, I mean, it's raining and your feet must really hurt. But apparently not. That was, I think, the 2017 general election. I think so, yeah, 2017 general election. Yep, so, I mean, I've pounded the pavement with Eddie. And I think I tried to keep my cool. It's quite easy to keep your cool when people are also asking you about their bins.
Yeah, true.
Maybe that's the thing. I need to set you up on a door knocking session with Eddie Izzard. And when people come and complain to you about the fact that the post office used to be open longer hours, you know, there is a dose of reality to this situation that
I can imagine. That's quite an equalising experience.
Yeah,
Yeah, so this as well as writing letters, I think that maybe, like, I should do a who would you like to door knock with? And we could actually do that. We could do, like, go out and actually do the door knocking. It would be very amusing. People say very, very amusing things on doorsteps. But can you imagine what it's like if you knock on somebody's door and it's you with Eddie Izzard?
Can you imagine?
Imagine if I rocked up at your door and said, oh, madam, have you got any local issues? You stood there with Eddie Izzard. Would be a bit like, ooh. Even if you've never heard of them, like, you know, if you'd never heard of Eddie Izzard, and it, still quite a domineering presence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's often fun when you do that. When, like, celebs come out and do a bit of political campaigning with you, it is, you get a funny reaction. So how would you sign off this letter, this love letter, where you're going to totally keep your cool throughout this letter, so it's going to be fine?
I think it would be, thank you for connecting with me. These are all thank you letters. Have you noticed? I began saying I'm banging to the thank you letters. But yeah, it did feel to me, watching those tapes, like a moment of connection. It was somebody else who's got, and she describes it actually as being a lid thinker. You know, you're not in the box, but you're not totally out of the box either. You're a lid thinker. To connect with a fellow lid thinker who's got that slightly surreal take on the world and that daft sense of humour, but is really into learning as well. I'd never known that there was another brain like that. So it would be thank you for the connection.
You're absolutely right about comedy. When I grew up in the 80s, and alternative comedy that was about, I mean, obviously we were living in particular political times at the time, but it was like accessible philosophy, a lot of it, like that you know, I could sit down and watch with my mum and dad, which I would never have watched. Like, I never watched, like, I didn't want to watch the Leith lectures or whatever they're called, the Reith lectures, but it was like accessible politics is largely done through the medium of comedy. It's a really, really important medium for getting people involved, also laughing with somebody. Like, there is, unless you make somebody cry, which I suppose you can do with sentimentality and good storytelling, but actually getting someone to laugh with you is the quickest way to make a shared emotion. And so it's very powerful, and actually politicians aren't very good at it. And that is part of the problem.
It's the quickest way to make someone learn something as well. And I used humour a lot in the talks that I do in schools, and sometimes it doesn't land, and then I don't know what to do. Like, I'll make a joke and no one gets it, and I'll go, oh, okay, this is the biggest tool I have at my disposal to make you care about your own and others' mental health.
Yeah, it is. I mean, also, yeah, that is, there's nothing worse than when you say something that you think is funny and then nobody laughs. Carl, that's like, that's a bullet to the soul right there. It is difficult. But, you know, if I think about Eddie Izzard and I think about the comedy, certainly LGBT sort of inspired and empowering comedy today, like, this is like real trailblazing. If you think of Eddie Izzard, like, Joe Lycett is one of my best friends. And, like, you know, a lot of that, like, gets to come from before, doesn't it? Because people blazed a trail on those things.
Yeah, and I love the idea of, it's not enough to be a kind of genre-defining comedian and to be able to do comedy in five different languages. Yeah, I'm going to be in Hollywood movies, and then I'm going to run 103 marathons or however.
The greatest, you think that running a marathon is difficult. Eddie Izzard was on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party. All I can say is I'd rather run 20 marathons. Those meetings sometimes are like 15 hours long. I mean, like, imagine a meeting that long.
I get angry when I'm bored. And I went to a meeting with another campaigner at Parliament once where, I mean, lots of things have happened at Parliament that have made me angry. But on this particular occasion, I was just bored. And I always think I'm doing really well at maintaining a poker face, but I actually have a face that can't hide what I'm thinking. I remember we came out of the meeting and my friend said to me, you know, they can see you, right? Like you have to get better.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I have had, because the press gallery looks down on us. I have had people send me things like from the press gallery, journalists saying things like, just your face is on camera, because I am literally going like, oh, tough one. Like, just like, yeah, seriously, check your face out. I'm like that. Mm-hmm. I'm incapable of a poker face. I don't know how to play poker, and that is the way it's going to have to stay. Because I would literally be like, woo, rubbing my hands together if I had it. I am just like physically cannot hide the way that I am feeling. So and boredom, that is enough to make you angry. I mean,
because there's so many things that you could be doing with your life, and yet this person is forcing you to be bored.
Yeah, and especially like when you're talking about something like really quite serious, and you think in the time that I've been in this meeting, we could have, you know, inoculated everybody in the Côte d'Ivoire. I'm like, that seriously, we're talking about this more than we're doing anything. Like, we're going around and we're talking. Sometimes we have meetings about preparing for the meetings that we're going to have. And I think I'm lost. I'm spiraling down the plug hole. I'm in a meeting, a pre-meeting about a meeting that's about a meeting. Yeah, that happens a lot. So, you know, marathon running, I actually think personally would be easier. I would rather run a marathon. And it has been such a pleasure to talk to you and your lovely thank you notes. It is nice. No one's ever like picked somebody that they really wanted to say something horrible about yet. So
I didn't even consider that as an option.
No, nobody does, but that is good, because really this is like a place in the world where people can be nice when so many places are just toxic and horrible and mean. It's nice when people can be nice. But I would like, you know, maybe one day someone to say thank you to this person who was just so awful that they taught me always the kind of person not to be.
I'll come back and do that another time. There are definitely some of those as well.
Yeah, I am very, very grateful all my political life, and will be for the rest of my political life. I'm grateful to Chris Grayling, because I once had a meeting with him before I was a member of parliament, and it undid all of my imposter syndrome. I was like, that, this dude, seriously, I can definitely become a member of parliament. So, you know, there is gratitude there, even if something's slightly negative. Still a thank you note. Thank you. I always think we should put Chris Grayling in charge of the patriarchy. Be broken within the week. Natasha, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and I will come on to LBC soon and we can chat some more. So thank you so much for sharing your brilliant people with us. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you follow Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips on the podcast provider of your choice. And why not write a letter to your friends telling them all about this podcast? You could also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod. Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.